Richard David is a philosopher at the University of Vienna. He is known for his cutting-edge research in scientific realism and anti-realism in contemporary string theory. In this interview and discussion, he addresses string theory from the perspective of structural realism and discusses the consequences of treating string theory as a final theory. Richard, realism and anti-realism has a long history in philosophy of science, especially obviously in the 20th century. Could you just give us a general overview of these two schools of thought and how they apply to the contemporary world of both philosophy and the scientific method?
Yeah, as you say, this is a very old question. And the basic question to be asked is whether there is a world that is independent of the human perspective. So the realist would say that there is a world independent of human perspective, while the anti-realist would deny that. Now, in principle, there are two ways to define an anti-realist position, to deny the realist position. The first way is just to deny that the realist claim is meaningful at all. And that's what, for example, the logical empiricists from the 1930s to the 1960s, which were a very influential group at that time, were doing. So they would say that it is important to be very precise on the meaning of our claims, and they would have a theory of meaning that was very rigid, and it was very closely related to empirical testing. So they would assume that we attribute meaning to a statement by defining the conditions of empirical testing of that claim. And if you think that way, of course, the statement of realism, the statement there is a world independent of human perspective, doesn't seem to be meaningful, because empirical testing always is based on the human perspective, so we have no way of testing that claim, and therefore no way of attributing meaning to the realist statement. However, in the 60s, it became increasingly doubtful to many philosophers whether those rigid criteria, those rigid theories of meaning were actually working. And so modern anti-realism mostly does not argue that way. Modern anti-realism is ready to grant to the realist that the realist claim is meaningful in principle, but would try to argue that actually there is no reason for a realist position. So we don't have reasons to assume that the realist claim is correct. So that would be the basic framework of the realism debate and also the scientific realism debate today.
To clarify some bits on scope, so for example, the logical empiricist or the logical positivist, the Vienna Circle, it's essentially the verification meaning of a statement, the analytic synthetic divide. So the meaning of a statement literally was how it was verified. Therefore, the condition that a scientific statement can mean reality is literally meaningless in a metaphysical sense. They didn't like metaphysical statements in that respect. I just wanted to get your thought on the history of anti-realism applied to some of the Kantian perspectives on philosophy. For example, this notion that we can never know things innately in themselves, only how they appear to our senses. Is this still a reasonably valid perspective to hold in the realist anti-realist debate?
Well, actually the logical empiricist perspective is already a step away from the Kantian way of thinking. So the logical empiricists would focus on the analysis of language, and they would not assume the Kantian concept, or they would refute the Kantian concept of synthetic a priori. And that step is not taken back later on when logical empiricism is being abandoned from the 60s onwards. So scientific realism debate, as it is discussed right now, does not rely on the concept or on the notion of a synthetic a priori either.
What is more important in the discussion of scientific realism is the distinction between observable and unobservable scientific objects, which are not directly
observable, like, for example, electrons, atoms, quarks, photons, and so on. So the question for the scientific realist is whether those objects, which are not observable, have the same, let's say, ontological status with respect to question of realism, as the objects of our everyday world. And this is the crucial question that is addressed in the modern scientific realism debate.
Thanks for clarifying that, Richard. So essentially, the logical empiricists moved away directly from Kant, and then since the 60s, we've had a move away from logical positivism and empiricism, and a kind of granting of a different status to the possibilities of scientific realism and the subjects that they study and their ontological status. And now the issue becomes observable, unobservable entities. So that is quite clearly some aspects of where we stand in philosophy and philosophy of science, physics and theoretical physics. And obviously the electron is a big issue, and string theory that we'll get to at the end. If you could just clarify some of these issues where there is much debate in terms of observable, unobservable entities. For example, no one has ever observe a quark or an electron in a lab, but the distinction seems to have moved from directly observable entity to their indirect effects. So for example, if you see how we measured the observation of the Higgs boson from last year, that wasn't a direct observation of the Higgs boson, but it's an observation of its indirect effects. So something is still operating here, yet it's not a direct observable entity of this thing that we're postulating, i.e. a quark or a Higgs boson or electron. How do you feel about that, and how can we clear up these issues at all?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. So there is an understanding, let's say, of a causal chain that leads from those posited scientific objects to our observations or something of that kind. Now, the question becomes whether this means that those objects which are posited by scientific theories, which describe, you know, in a way, try to account for our observations, whether those objects are out there in the external world, whether they are real, one might say, or whether they just constitute one element of a scientific theory that does not really aim at identifying real objects which are somewhere in which exist in the outside world, but scientific theories which just aim at accounting for the data. They just aim at being empirically adequate, as some philosophers formulated that. So if the second is the case, if scientific theories only aim at empirical adequacy, they are not concerned with the question of scientific realism, and therefore they should not, say those anti-realist philosophers, they should not be the basis for developing a realist position. On the other hand, the scientific realist would say, and this is one of the core arguments of the scientific realist in the modern debate, that we have to understand the reasons why science is so conspicuously successful. More specifically, why science can make successful predictions and why science is doing that very often, quite frequently. And the scientific realist would argue that the only way to understand that is based on assuming that the scientific objects posited by the theories are real. So the scientific realist would say, if those objects are real, this can provide an explanation why the theories which have found the correct objects are often predictively successful, while if those theories would posit objects which are not real, then there wouldn't be any explanation why scientific success occurs. So that's the that's the difference of opinion that arises here.
I believe one area of this, for example, the scientific realist that basically makes the assertion that it's unlikely that science would have all this predictive and explanatory power to high accuracy, something like the no miracles argument, that it's not a coincidence. Now, with what you were saying in terms of the realist, anti-realist divide, in terms of whether it actually gets at any kind of objective ontological reality or whether it's just empirical adequacy, this relates to, I'm assuming here, and you can just clarify this, that it also ties into what you were saying about the contemporary divides between realism and anti-realism. That is that the anti-realists may grant the position that it's just empirically adequate and that it can't say anything else about reality with a capital R, so to speak, and truth with a capital T, as where the realist would say that it literally is true, that these theoretical statements are literally true. So what do you think about that, and how important is the language of scientific theory in this area?
I think one has to make two more points in order to understand the full extent of that debate. First, one has to have a look at the core anti-realist argument, which is called the pessimistic meta-induction. And this argument is directed against the no miracles argument, which you mentioned, which is the argument that we have to explain the conspicuous predictive success of science. And now the anti-realist would argue that actually there were quite some scientific theories which used to be predictively successful, but nevertheless posited scientific objects which later turned out not to refer to anything in the external world. One famous example is the light ether, which was part of electrodynamics in the 19th century and an integral part of that theory. And based on that, the entire theoretical concept was very, very successful. However, later, Einstein's theory of relativity led to the understanding that actually there cannot be a light ether. So that would be an example of a theory that did posit objects which later turned out not to refer, in spite of being empirically successful. And the anti-realist would argue that given we know that such examples have occurred in the past, we have no reason to assume that they will not occur in the future. So he would argue for this meta-induction, and on that basis would reject the idea that the objects of our current theories actually refer. So that would be the controversy between no miracles argument on the one hand and the pessimistic meta-induction on the other hand. Now, if we look at scientific theories, in particular at theoretical physics throughout the 20th century, there is one more aspect that complicates the situation. And that aspect is that the traditional understanding of an ontological object is strongly changed by those scientific theories. So a lot of aspects of one would usually attribute to an ontological object are just not consistent with modern physical theories, like quantum theory, special relativity, general relativity, and so on. So the question is, what do we do with our understanding of scientific realism in such a situation? Now, one important point that became more crucial to the debate on that basis is reference to truth. So what happens is that in a, let's say, in a naive context where you want to stick to a naive concept of ontological objects, it is fairly unproblematic to make claims like there are ontological objects like atoms out there, because we have a direct extrapolation from our everyday world objects to our understanding of what object, well, atoms would look like. However, in a more advanced scientific context, this is not that easy because the theory only tells us how we should define an ontological object at all. Therefore, in a more advanced scientific context, it becomes more important to focus on the claim that theories provide true or approximately true statements about the world. And now only in the second step, we have to ask, okay, obviously statements of scientific theories are not exactly true because we always know we must expect further evolution of scientific theories, but they may be approximately true. And what do we mean from a realist perspective by calling something approximately true? And only based on that second step, we return to reference to external objects, because then the ontological scientific realist would argue that a theory is approximately true if the core objects posited within that framework refer to something in the external world. So that would be the understanding of scientific realism in such an advanced context. And my personal perspective on the debate at that stage actually is that there is a kind of impasse. But on the one hand, you have good arguments for scientific realism, or at any rate for making the point that something, some philosophical input is required for understanding the success of scientific theory building. But on the other hand, there is also the anti-realist has quite strong points. So the arguments against scientific realism also seem reasonable. So it's quite difficult to find a solution to that debate in this context. Now, there are many attempts to search for an intermediate position, a position that accounts for the arguments on both sides, but it's very difficult to find a way through that jungle, let's say, of philosophical reasoning.
In a second, if possible, I will actually get you to perhaps elaborate a little bit of what you can on some of these intermediate positions. But just going back, just to summarize some aspects, if I could, in terms of realism and anti-realism and where we are with this notion of objective truth and ontological status or approximate truth. So perhaps another way to think of this kind of idea would be the realist says that, okay, scientific theories that refer to this objective data that we have in the world is approximately true, but we always know that it's open to revision and things move on, but it's still always aiming at something being approximately true. So we've gone from, say, the atom to the nucleus, the proton, the electron, and now we have quarks. We have revisions to it, but they're still the same ontological objects being studied and identified, just with new add-ons to it, as where if you were to take something like the paradigm shift from obviously Thomas Kuhn's Scientific Revolution's great work, would say, no, it's not just a revision to these ontological objects, it's an actual change of the paradigm. So, for example, gravity, as what was understood in Newton's paradigm, is no longer the same as it's understood in an Einsteinian perspective, and we can't just say that we're moving closer and closer to truth, we're actually redefining it as we go along. You could argue for both positions, realism and anti-realism. And what are some of these intermediate positions, and how do you evaluate them?
So maybe the most interesting intermediate position, and one that is quite popular today, is structural realism. This is a position that was first formulated as what one calls epistemic structural realism by John Worrell in the late 1980s. And the basic idea is to give due credit to arguments on both sides. So Worrell would say that actually there is something to the pessimistic meta-induction. There are those changes of ontology from one scientific theory to the next, and therefore there is the problem that scientific theories may be empirically successful despite choosing the wrong set of ontological objects from our today's perspective. On the other hand, Worrell would also claim that we need to provide an explanation for the predictive success of science. So what he would suggest is that actually the problem for scientific realism is that scientific realism in its classical form sticks to ontology. It sticks to identifying the scientific realist position with holding a specific ontology true. And Worrell would argue that we have to move away from that understanding. We should rather confine our claims of continuity to structures in scientific theories. So the idea of structural realism is that while ontologies change, the structural characteristics from one theory to its successor theory actually remain approximately the same. So there is a continuity of structure even in cases where there is no continuity of objects. That is one intermediate position. And then a development of structural realism that is more closely related to an analysis of modern theories in science, in particular in physics, is called ontic structural realism. And the difference between the two positions, between the epistemic and the ontic form of structural realism, is that for the epistemic structural realist, the question is what we can know about the continuity of scientific posits, and therefore which kind of realist statements we are justified to make, independently from the question whether there may be ontological objects which are actually stable, and some of them may be in our present theories, but we just have no way of knowing that. While the ontic structural realist would rather look at the evolution of scientific theory building and at modern theories like quantum mechanics, quantum field theory, and he would argue that actually if you look at the evolution of modern physics, the pessimistic meta-induction is not the core problem. There may be some cases of changes of ontology, but mostly those changes are in periods of science where the scientific theories are not yet mature, or there is some explanation why this problem arose in those cases. While we look at, when we look at 20th century physics, the problem is a different one, with the ontic structural realists say. The problem is that actually those theories are not compatible with any form of ontological realism. So they don't allow for a consistent ontological statement anymore, which means that the claim that there is, that the structural level of theories is more important than the ontological level, or let's say more fundamental than the ontological one, is a claim that is based on understanding those theories themselves. And therefore, the ontic structural realist would claim that being a structural realist is an answer to our current state of physics, rather than an answer to the observation that there have been breaks and ontological changes in physics in the past. So that, and this ontic structural realism is a quite interesting position, but of course, as all those positions, it has problems of its own if you look carefully at the details of the theory.
From what you've just summarised there, I'm actually more inclined to perhaps go with the anti-structural realist position than the structural realist position, because from just my understanding there, the structural realist position from the Worrell position is still leaning a bit too much to realism, i.e. there's just saying there's a structure out there and some of the ontological statuses within it change, but it's just the structure that remains the same. So that is still positing some kind of external structural reality that's always there.
Yeah, that's right. It's epistemic in the sense that it does not make any statement on the question whether there actually are ontological objects out there. It just makes a statement about our ability of identifying those objects.
Could you see both of these playing into a traditional Kantian view that we can never know phenomena as it is in themselves, or is this something that you still want to put to the side a bit?
I personally would not favor a strongly Kantian perspective on that entire debate, but if you would compare the two positions of epistemic and ontic structural realism from a Kantian perspective, what you might say is that the epistemic version of structural realism may be closer in spirit to a Kantian perspective, because the epistemic position makes a distinction between our epistemic access to the world and what's actually out there. So there is something that is maybe reminiscent of a Kantian perspective, while the ontic structural realism doesn't have that element. The ontic structural realist actually assumes that we are in a position to extract from an analysis of our present physical theories an understanding of the ontological content, or let's say of the ontic character of our world. So it is a in some sense the claim made by the ontic structural realist is a stronger claim, being an ontic claim than what the epistemic structural realist would allow for.
As you can see, I'm always pushing Kant on everyone. So Richard, so far you've explained and summarized both historical aspects of realism and anti-realism, how they've evolved throughout history, observable, unobservable entities, the validity of theoretical statements and how they apply to ontological statements in the world, and where we currently are with the debate and some intermediate positions. Now, with your expertise, I think a great way to contextualize all this and conclude on some of these aspects would be to talk about your very interesting work, which was Realism in the Age of String Theory. How do we really need to get hold of realism in the age of string theory? Because essentially string theory makes, at this moment in time, no full-on predictions. It can't be tested, and clearly it can't be observed. Paramount in this is how this does relate to realism and your work, Realism in String Theories.
I should first say a few sentences about string theory, what it is, and how it, and what its scientific status at this point is. The basic idea, the aim of string theory, is to provide a universal theory of all interactions. So we have come a long way in physics, unifying different kinds of interactions, different regimes of descriptions of physical phenomena, and so on. And in the early 70s, physicists ended up basically having two fundamentally different parts of physical description. On the one hand, there was a coherent understanding of nuclear interactions, so microphysics, as one wanted to call it. And on the other side, there was the description of gravitation based on Einstein's theory of general relativity. And it turned out extremely difficult to integrate those two theories into one coherent whole. But it on the other hand, it turns out that it is very important to do so in order to have a full understanding of, in particular, of the very early phases of the universe. So string theory aims at doing that, and the basic idea of string theory is very simple, actually. It is to replace the the point-like elementary objects of particle physics by extended one-dimensional objects, the so-called strings. And it turns out that once you try to do that and you try to make that consistent, it enforces a lot of new and very, very interesting and very complex structure on you. So you end up with a theory that has characteristics which go far beyond what is immediately implied by our observations of the world. Now, the problem is that we make all those kind of predictions, not specific predictions with respect to empirical data, but predictions with respect to the structure that characterizes an adequate description of our world, and we have no way to test that empirically. At any rate, at this point. Because the characteristic scale of string theory is so much higher than what we are able to test at this point, that there is no chance of under normal circumstances, if there may be specific interesting specific conditions where we can do some testing, but under normal circumstances we have to expect that there is no way of making empirical tests of the core predictions of string theory in the foreseeable future. So there is this problem of empirical confirmation, and there is an even, maybe even more troubling problem, which is that people have been working on string theory for 40 years by now, but they have not come up with a complete theory. They just have a certain level of understanding of some aspects of the theory, but they have no complete theory, and one consequence of that is that they have no way of extracting specific empirical predictions from that theory at this point. So it is an incomplete theory, and it's a theory that is not empirically confirmed, but nevertheless, it has a crucial position in high energy physics cosmology today. It is very influential. It, in a way, it binds together all other theories which are dealing with questions in fundamental, other questions, related questions in fundamental physics. And it is quite strongly believed by its exponents. So it's a very peculiar situation string theory finds itself in at this point. Now, if one asks the question whether this has anything to do with the question of scientific realism, it turns out that there are a number of aspects of string theory which are very interesting in that respect. In particular, there are two crucial claims of string theory which are of considerable interest for the realism debate. First, string theory posits a specific, string theory has a very peculiar characteristic, which is called duality. It is a property of string theory that you can formulate different versions, or let's say models of string theory, and then it turns out that those different formulations of string theory, which actually are based on different symmetry structures, different positionings of the strings in space, different topological structure. So everything, virtually everything is different in one such formulation of string theory than in the other. Nevertheless, it turns out that these duality relations connect those theories and imply that those two formulations are empirically equivalent. So what happens is that in terms of a realist formulation, you might say that the theory, that the two formulations of the theory imply very different, fundamentally different ontological content, even fundamentally different structure, if you think of structures in space and time, and nevertheless, they are empirically equivalent. So this, of course, is a strong argument against ontological realism, because it seems to indicate that there is no uniquely identifiable ontological content of our most fundamental theory, if string theory is a viable theory. And it is even an argument against, let's say, conventional forms of structural realism, with assume that structures should be placed in space and time, because even at that level, there is no unique selection of structure in space and time, and there is no unique formulation of space or topological characteristic of space and time either. So in this sense, string theory seems to be at variance with most forms of scientific realism. On the other hand, string theory also makes what is called a final theory claim. So string theory, based on its own structure and based on once again based on dualities, actually, makes the claim that it is not possible, if string theory is a viable theory on its own, at its own characteristic scale, it is not possible to go beyond the theory and find a new theory at high energy scales. And the reason is that string theory posits a minimal length scale which can be identified with the characteristic scale of the theory. So in other words, what it says is that once you move beyond the characteristic scale of string theory, the scale that is called the string scale, you actually only find statements which are redundant. All statements about smaller distances than this length scale actually can be expressed in terms of statements about larger distances. And the connection between those two statements can be made based on one of those duality relations. So what happens here is that for the first time in science, a final theory claim is not a claim that is enforced on a theory from the outside. So you might say, okay, I have that theory and I think it's so nice that probably there won't be any better theory anytime. But that's, of course, a final theory claim that is based only on your own assessment of the theory. In the case of string theory, the final theory claim emerges from the structure of the theory itself. So if you look at this claim, then this seems to indicate support for some form of scientific realism, because, as we have seen, one strong, or maybe the most interesting argument against scientific realism was pessimistic meta-induction, was the idea that there is theory succession and the next theory actually can have a very different ontological structure, or maybe even very different structure than the last one. Now, if we are dealing with a final theory, then this argument would not be valid anymore, if we have reasons to assume that we are dealing with a final theory. Let's put it that way. So once again, we have faced a situation where we have arguments which seem to work in favor of scientific realism, and we have other arguments which seem to work against scientific realism. So also in this respect, string theory is a very interesting theory, and one can once again try to find intermediate positions based on implications of string theory, and that was what I was doing in these papers and in the book, actually.
if it was to provide a final theory, wouldn't that be dangerous? Because, for example, right now, a dominant paradigm for the last 50 years is the Big Bang Theory, and there's multiple reasons from many different fields of why we believe to be true, and that's the case. But that's not to say that in the future we won't have any more experiments or observations that perhaps really do make us question the Big Bang Theory. So even though within the theory of string theory itself is this final theory, the problem of this meta-induction may persist, because in the future we may still have anomalies that make us doubt string theory as any kind of final theory.
Of course, you're absolutely right that a final theory claim always is a philosophically very problematic thing. If you look at final theory claims which are made from outside the theory, there is no clear foundation for those claims. If you make, as in the case of string theory, if you make them from within the theory, it doesn't seem to provide a very good argument against the idea that there may be an anomaly, empirical anomaly, that requires a new theory. And this new theory that differs from string theory, of course, may not have support the string theoretical final theory claim. So it may, for example, not support T-duality that is responsible for the final theory claim in the context of string theory. So one may always say there is something very strange about this. The final theory claim seems to be valid as long as you trust the theory, but once you move away from the theory, once you understand that you need a different theory to account for some empirical anomaly, the final theory claim may be invalidated or should be invalidated by the new theory. Now, there is no fundamental argument against this, of course. So final theory claim can never be deduced from a theory, not from string theory. The way the argument, if one wants to make sense of the final theory claim in the context of string theory, one has to look at one more interesting phenomenon that may be called a phenomenon at the meta level with respect to string theory. And that is the role of limitations to scientific underdetermination, limitations to the underdetermination of theory building, which characterize the scientific process up to string theory and also within the evolution of string theory. So what I mean by limitations to scientific underdetermination is the idea, or let's say what I mean by, let's start by the understanding by the concept of with the concept of underdetermination itself. The one may have the general expectation, looking at a scientific theory and looking at some empirical data, that there can be alternatives to that scientific theory which can also account for that data. So usually that's the way one wants to view science. For a number of reasons. One reason is that we expect theory succession, so we always expect that there can be a new theory that has the old theory as its limiting case, but actually has different characteristics and nevertheless can account for the present data. Then we have also cases where we know that there are different theories which can account for the same empirical data. Then there is the philosophical understanding that in principle, a scientist who is sufficiently diligent and sufficiently clever could account for any regularity patterns he finds in the world by developing a scientific theory. That's the job of the scientist, right? So those are different arguments why we would want to, if we think within the framework of canonical philosophy of science, why we would want to assume that there is something like limitation to underdetermination of theory building. However, there are also reasons to assume that those limitations are strongly limited. They are not as this underdetermination is limited. So it's not as radical as one might naively assume. And one reason to think so is that there is empirical predictive success. If we assume a situation where scientific theories can be developed for any pattern, regularity pattern of empirical data whatsoever, it would be completely incomprehensible why empirical success can occur. Because at any stage, based on a certain set of empirical data, there would be lots of different ways to develop that theory on in a way that accounts for new empirical data. So we would have a spectrum of many different patterns, predictions of patterns of future data, and we could never be sure that we have chosen the right one. So based on the observation that our theories are so often predictively successful, we must assume that scientific underdetermination is strongly limited. And if we now enter the context of theory building in high energy physics, this limitation to scientific underdetermination is particularly striking. Often it is the case that scientists try to solve a conceptual problem and they only come up with one individual solution. And later it turns out that actually the theory they came up with is predictively successful. So there is a strong directedness in high energy physics that is guided not that much by empirical data. Of course, it's also guided by empirical data to the extent it is available, but it is quite strongly guided by consistency arguments, by the way scientists try to find consistent theories, and they understand they actually only find one specific theory that is consistent, and this turns out to be the correct one. So we have, on that basis, at the meter level, observational data with respect to the success rate of theories, one might say, that indicates that underdetermination is limited. Now, if we look at such a statement, this statement is of the very kind of statement we need in order to support also a final theory claim. We are not quite there, and actually it's still quite difficult to get from a statement of limitations to underdetermination to a final theory claim, but statements of limitations to underdetermination can actually support final theory claims. And only if we work in a scientific context where those limitations are very strong, seem to be very strong, a final theory claim can make sense. So if we understand why final theory claims occur in string theory and why they seem interesting in the context of string theory, this has a lot to do with the general character of research in the context of string physics and of high energy physics in general.
Those two points are attached there, but before we actually get into the use of a final theory, but what you were saying is because of this research attitude that people working in string theory have, which is a consistency in a theory that is no longer contradictory, the issue here with regards to realism or any type of realism isn't necessarily its unobservable, observable entity divider, it's empirical verification, but the fact of theoretical elegance and the explanatory power of higher end physics and what we can use these for in a final theory.
Actually, what you were saying right now also shows the direction in which one has to think here. And what is interesting now, if one wants to understand the connection between those ideas on limitations to underdetermination and the scientific realism debate, it is interesting to look at one specific recent criticism of scientific realism that I think is very insightful and actually grasps a very important aspect of the scientific realism debate. That's criticism by Kyle Stanford in a recent book and some recent papers. And Kyle Stanford argues that one crucial problem for scientific realism is the threat of unconceived alternatives, as he calls them. So this is, at first, this is just a rephrasing of the threat expressed by the pessimistic meta-induction, right? Unconceived alternatives are those alternative theories which haven't been thought of today, but which are still, so to say, out there. And we might find them in the future, and they actually might turn out to be the more promising theories than the ones we have now. And therefore, they might contain the correct set of ontological objects or whatever. Now, what Stanford says is that actually a claim of scientific realism is not primarily a claim about the present theory, but it is a claim on unconceived alternatives, on the spectrum of unconceived alternatives. Because by making the claim that our present theory posits the correct ontological objects, for example, we make the claim that we do not believe that there is a considerable spectrum of unconceived alternatives. Otherwise, we wouldn't be justified to make the realist claim. So what Stanford therefore argues is that in order to understand whether scientific realism is a meaningful position and whether it can be meaningfully argued based on our present-day science, we have to ask the question whether science actually addresses the question of unconceived alternatives. And Stanford looks at some examples where science actually obviously does not do so, and where actually there were unconceived alternatives which later emerged and which led to a refutation of the initial theory and so on. So what he claims is that since the assessment of the spectrum of unconceived alternatives does not play a very important role in science, or let's say in many contexts of science, it is just not justified to have a scientific realist position and connect that to the present scientific understanding. And I think that's a very interesting way of viewing the situation. Now, if we look at this kind of criticism from the perspective of string theory, of course the answer would be, well, not just of string theory, but actually from the perspective of high energy physics in the later half of the 20th century, let's put it that way. You find an immediate answer to that criticism. You can say, well, actually, in those contexts, the assessment of limitation to underdetermination does play a very important role. And if you look at string theory in particular, you can say, actually, in the case of string theory, the assessment of limitations to underdetermination is the only argument for trusting the theory, because we don't have empirical confirmation. We only have this assessment of limitations to underdetermination. So there is an interesting twist now, because looking at Stanford's criticism, you might say empirical confirmation is, of course, crucial for the scientific evolution, for the assessment of our theories. However, it does not lead us towards a scientific realist position on its own. Because for the reason that empirical confirmation does not address the question of unconceived alternatives. On the other hand, The assessment of limitations to underdetermination does exactly that. So it seems to be the more powerful argument in the context of the scientific realism debate than empirical confirmation. So there, one might understand this in a, let's say, slightly, in a quite surprising way, as saying that even though empirical confirmation is more important for establishing the viability of a scientific theory, what is more important for establishing a realist claim about the scientific theory actually is the assessment of limitation to underdetermination. And this seems to be stronger in the case of string theory than in the case of empirically confirmed theories.
So along the way, we might actually obviously be redefining what constitutes scientific realism. And just to touch on this perhaps potential paradox between the alternative of theory. So on the one hand, because we can't empirically test theories like string theory, we don't come up with alternative theories. Yet at the same time, because of the consistency that the explanatory power of string theory gives us, we don't necessarily have to come up with alternative theories. So we're kind of stuck in this riddle.
Well, I would say that our inability to test the theory empirically prevents us from finding alternative theories. We might still do that. So, and actually, a lot of research is going into the search for alternatives. So, of course, one might say that it's a rather promising strategy for finding alternative theories to look at empirical anomalies. So empirical anomalies lead the way towards new theories, and if they are absent, finding new theories gets more difficult. But it's not the case that it is necessarily blocked by the absence of empirical data. And actually, there are also reasons to assume that the absence of empirical data would support a proliferation of various scientific theories. In many contexts, that's actually the case. If you assume a certain set of empirical data and some basic scientific concepts which are capable of accounting for that data, and then based on those concepts, we speculate about new science. And since there is no empirical data around, we might have very different opinions based on our personal priorities about the direction in which science should proceed. So we might find one theory that seems natural from one perspective, a different theory that seems natural from a different perspective. And so we would have a whole range of scientific theories, which is there because of the very fact that there is not sufficient empirical data to select between them. So for example, if we look at earlier stages, at any rate, of the debate on the extinction of dinosaurs, and people had many ideas about the extinction of dinosaurs, but there just wasn't the hard data to test those theories, and therefore to exclude all theories except for one. Now, one might expect that in a case like high energy physics, where it's not just string theory that isn't supported by empirical data, but the entire field suffers from an absence of empirical testing, one might assume that there are lots of different theories are around, which is not the case. And the reason why it is not the case is that consistency arguments in the absence of empirical data are capable of enforcing a directedness of theory building.
Sure. They can do basically a lot of the justification and heavy lifting behind the applications
right.
of the theory.
Yeah. Yeah.
Great. Well, Richard, what are you working on right now that not necessarily have to do with realism or string theory, but just your general research going forward in philosophy of science?
Well, lots of what I'm doing right now is related to this question of limitations to scientific underdetermination. And the question is, one important question is, whether one can find a significant role of limitations to scientific underdetermination in other contexts, physics, of fundamental physics, but also in more general philosophical contexts. So one thing I'm working on right now is looking at the case of Higgs' discovery, and it seems that the discovery of the Higgs particle is, of course, an interesting case because it is a case where we do have empirical data and empirical confirmation. But nevertheless, it turns out that limitations to underdetermination do play an important and interesting role in that context as well. And then another interesting question that arises more generally with respect to arguments which support limitations to scientific underdetermination is whether one can formalize those arguments. There is a very popular method of formalizing strategies of theory confirmation in a philosophical context, which is called Bayesian confirmation theory. And what I'm working on with collaborators, Stefan Hartmann and Jan Sprenger, is trying to formalize specific arguments which support limitations to underdetermination in a Bayesian context, in a Bayesian framework. And it actually turns out that you can do that. We succeeded in one specific case, which is the case of the so-called no alternatives argument, basically the argument that you believe a theory because you haven't found any other theories. And it seems like a very simple and rather, let's say, treacherous argument. It turns out that it does, this argument can, under specific and quite plausible conditions, constitute theory confirmation in a Bayesian sense. So if I make the observation that I haven't found alternative theories, this can count as theory confirmation for it. I have. So that's another context of research for me right